The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the February 17 and 24, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine. An arachnophobe pays homage to the spider. They're venomous cannibals hiding in our homes. With something like 15 quadrillion spiders around, we can't escape them. Can we learn to love them? By Catherine Schultz. Back in my footloose 20s, I lived for a year in Costa Rica, where I worked at a school in the Central Highlands and worked even harder, by reluctant necessity, at overcoming my lifelong horror of crawly things. Before the Costa Rican Tourism Board comes after me, I will say, in defense of that part of the world, that I have never lived anywhere else so ecologically magnificent. Every day, I commuted to work on a trail lined with ferns and bromeliads and the enchanted fortresses of strangler figs, while two-toed sloths lolled overhead and butterflies as big as greeting cards opened their dull brown wings to reveal a blue as brilliant as the cloak of the Virgin Mary. At night, the moon cast shadows of avocado trees along the dirt roads, and the stars amassed in layers a billion deep. There were volcanoes, there were waterfalls, there were three kinds of monkeys. There was a dry season and a wet season, and in between them an entire rainbow season, as if the local weather had been designed by Lisa Frank. On clear days, I would look out over verdant folds of mountains to where the sun glinted off the Pacific Ocean and reckon myself pretty much in paradise. Still, there is a snake in every garden, though it was not the nation's infamous pit vipers that scared me. Before taking the job, I had not appreciated the biological coordinates of Costa Rica, south of the Tropic of Cancer, north of the Tropic of Capricorn, right in the middle of the arthropod zone. Once I got there, however, this fact became appallingly unignorable. My roommates in my new house included ants that looked like Star Wars extras, beetles that looked like U.S. Army-issued vehicles, and scorpions that unfortunately looked exactly like scorpions and made themselves at home in my sock drawer. At night, mosquitoes gloated in my ear, and heavy-set moths, furry enough to be mammals and big enough too, ricocheted around my bedroom walls, sounding like the opening scene of Apocalypse Now. All this I could have lived with, however unhappily. But I was completely, abjectly, characterologically, and possibly clinically unprepared to deal with the spiders. The scale of this problem made itself clear soon after I arrived, when I went to the kitchen to get a drink of water and, yarg! The creature in my sink was thick, hairy, hideous, Halloween-ready in its outfit of orange and black, and easily the size of my hand. As I later learned, a Costa Rican red-leg tarantula. That species is formally known as Mycophoboma mesomelus, and if you guess that the first part translates roughly as gigantic and terrifying, you're right. This particular one had crawled into my sink from, I presume, the depths of our collective psyche, and looked like the result of a collaboration between Stephen King, Louise Bourgeois, and Hieronymus Bosch. I made a noise that must have been audible in Guatemala, leapt backward through the air a good 6 feet, and flattened myself against a wall. What was I supposed to do? Like every self-respecting arachnophobe, I had spent my entire life prior to that moment making sure that I was never alone in a room with an arachnid, not even, say, a daddy long legs, a perfectly harmless creature weighing perhaps a hundredth of an ounce. Now, here I was, alone, not only in a room, but effectively in a nation, confronted by a quarter pound of spider flesh. Yet, I could not kill the creature. Not because I had, in the moment, any ethical or sentimental objection to doing so, but because I couldn't think of a nearby weapon certain to do the trick. Plus, no way was I getting close enough to deal the fatal blow or, heaven forbid, hear the dying crunch of that enormous carapace. My feelings about spiders were the opposite of those old Wild West posters. I didn't want them dead or alive. I didn't even want them imaginary. I had been known to close books and flip over magazines to avoid having to see some particularly loathsome member of the order Araneae. Perhaps you share this feeling. Perhaps you, too, have spent your life self-evacuating from rooms with suspiciously shaped cracks in the ceiling. Perhaps even reading this is making your skin crawl. In that case, you will understand why I not only fled my house that day, but seriously considered fleeing the country. What's harder to understand is why, a couple of months ago, having long since left Costa Rica, but having never left behind my intense arachnophobia, I decided to pick up a copy of The Lives of Spiders, published by Princeton, by Zemina Nelson, a professor of animal behavior at the University of Canterbury, New Zealand. What can I say? It was November. All around me, people were obsessively reading about things they feared and despised, in the hope that comprehension could lead to compassion and change. For my part, I figured I'd start small. The Lives of Spiders is an unusual volume, part textbook, part encyclopedia, part coffee table book for those whose taste in decor runs towards shabby eek. Its detailed scientific information is conveyed with endearing, if not entirely contagious, enthusiasm and accompanied by full-page photographs, which someone who is not me might possibly regard as beautiful. In addition to excursus on spider behavior, ecology, biology, it contains miniature biographies of 40 distinct species. That is, I regret to report, a tiny fraction of the total number. To date, we know of some 50,000 spider species, though, like this magazine, they are hard to keep up with since new ones pile up every week. Scientists suspect that the true number is at least double that, while the number of individual spiders likely clocks in somewhere north of 15 quadrillion. These are not evenly distributed across ecosystems, of course, but you cannot escape them anywhere except Antarctica. Like us, spiders are geographically intrepid. They thrive across rainforests, cloud forests, boreal forests, grasslands, wetlands, deserts, savannas, steppes, caves, mountains, marshes, and bogs. One species, the diving bell spider, builds its web beneath the surface of lakes and ponds, attaches an air bubble to it for breathing, and lives out its days underwater. Within these diverse environs, spiders distribute themselves the way Manhattanites do, crowding in at every level from garden apartment to penthouse. In your average patch of eastern woodlands, there will be spiders burrowing beneath the soil, scuttling through the leaf litter, crouching in the bushes, dangling from the tree limbs, and spinning webs high up in the canopy. If your reaction to this is to vow to spend more time in the great indoors, you underestimate your nemesis. One recent study of private homes in North Carolina found spiders in 100% of them. As you might expect of a zoological order capable of living anywhere from the Mongolian steppe to a ranch house in Fayetteville, spiders are remarkably diversified. They range in size from a hundredth of an inch to 5 inches across. And that's just their bodies, because arachnologists, who clearly don't think like the rest of us, generally do not include leg length when reporting the size of a spider. To appreciate the psychological failure of this descriptive practice, consider the giant huntsman spider. Technically an inch long, which is bad enough, but throw in the legs and the creature is a full foot from end to end. Other characteristics vary just as widely. Some spiders live for less than a year, like mayflies, while others live for more than 40, like camels. Some have 8 eyes, while others have none. Some female spiders lay a single egg, while others lay more than 3,000. Still, there are some things that all spiders have in common, beyond their ability to make me levitate. Most obviously, they all belong to the class Arachnida, a spectacularly unlovable limb of the Tree of Life, whose other members include scorpions, mites, and ticks. All Arachnida have 8 legs, and outside of the microscopic tardigrade, only Arachnida have 8 legs. Do not malign the wonderful octopus, which has 8 arms. Also, all spiders are predators. There is one partial exception to this rule, Bagheera kiplingi, a largely herbivorous spider native to Mexico and Central America. Some other species will occasionally nibble on a plant, technically making them omnivores, but on the whole, what distinguishes the spiderly appetite is its stunning carnivorousness. Collectively, spiders eat at least 500 million pounds of meat per year, more than the amount consumed by human beings. What exactly do these voracious, flesh-eating creatures consume? Insects, of course. Also fish, tadpoles, frogs, lizards, and the occasional vertebrate, mice, shrews, voles, bats. The largest spider, the Goliath bird-eater tarantula, does, in fact, eat birds. One spider, Evarcha culicifera, which lives in Kenya and Uganda, feeds almost entirely on us, although, thank goodness, indirectly. Its preferred diet is mosquitoes engorged with human blood. Another thing spiders eat with great gusto is one another. Every known variety of spider can engage in cannibalism, and some do so with particular enthusiasm, most often during or immediately after copulation, with the female almost always doing the eating. Up to 80% of male wasp spiders, for instance, get eaten during their first attempt at mating, and some male widow spiders, apparently resigned to their fate, deliberately flip themselves over after sex in order to be consumed. Male dark fishing spiders, meanwhile, die spontaneously during sex, saving the females the trouble of killing them prior to dinner. In some species, a female spider will let herself be devoured by her spiderlings, a behavior known as suicidal maternal care. Then, there are the many spiders that simply stalk their fellow arachnids, killing and eating them as ruthlessly as if they were no more closely related than we are to turkeys and tuna. If I were a spider, in short, I would still be afraid of spiders. As an order, they possess a whole suite of lethal characteristics and abilities, capable of ambushing, snaring, swarming, or deceiving their prey. To these ends, they are equipped with more cognitive dexterity than you might imagine, plus tooth-like structures, tarsal claws, and fangs, which, in the magnified images in Nelson's book, look like they could belong to, respectively, great white sharks, jaguars, and Carmilla. But the most effective weapons of the spider, not to mention the ones most central to its fearsome reputation, are the arachnid equivalents of the iron fist and the velvet glove, venom and silk. Whatever your feelings about spiders, spider silk is an astonishing material. Although a strand of it is far skinnier than a human hair, it has more tensile strength than steel and can absorb more impact than Kevlar. It's partly because it's also extremely ductile, meaning it can stretch many times its normal length before breaking, which is why a bird can fly straight into a web without destroying it. Conveniently for spiders, silk also supercontracts when wet. Subject it to a good rainstorm and, no matter how much it has been stretched and strained, it will return to its original condition. This ultra-tough material starts out as a liquid stored in glands in the spider's abdomen. From there, it flows into organs called spinnerets, of which a spider may have up to 8, each ending in tiny spigots, as Nelson writes. The spider then extrudes the silk manually, so to speak, pulling it out of a spinneret with its hind legs and thereby realigning the protein molecules so that the formerly liquid substance turns solid. Whether you regard this as evidence of the awesome inventiveness of nature or the deeply alien creepiness of spiders is a matter of perspective. Either way, the number of things that spiders can do with their silk would impress even E.B. White. Most obviously, they can use it to build webs, which range in size from half an inch in diameter to 30 square feet, and in sophistication from simple triangles to elaborate spirals and funnels. Because webs co-evolved with insects, and therefore with the rise of insect flight, they can be found not only stretched across ground cover and rocks, but also in vertical sheets that can sometimes span entire rivers. For reasons that remain somewhat mysterious, certain spider species decorate their webs with bits of plant matter or the mutilated remains of victims, like Charles II hanging the head of Oliver Cromwell on Westminster Hall. Others decorate with the silk itself, the most famous and enigmatic example being the St. Andrew's Cross spider, which weaves a cross into the center of its web. Although we think of webs as a defining feature of spiderhood, only about half the species build them. Yet all spiders produce silk. Its many other uses include a dispersal method known as ballooning, in which spiders, typically young ones, climb up something tall, point their bellies skyward, and release lines of silk that form a parachute and carry them off in the breeze. Spiders have been known to travel hundreds of miles this way, sometimes landing on ships in the middle of the ocean. They also use silk to line their nests, to build cocoons for their eggs, and to subdue their prey. Burrowing spiders stretch silken trip lines outside their homes to alert them to the presence of predators or dinner. Jumping spiders establish safety lines prior to leaping across a landscape, like rock climbers adding anchors while ascending a cliff. Widow spiders drop a line of silk from their webs and essentially go fishing. Bolus spiders swing a line of silk overhead and lasso their prey. Male spiders, which use one organ to produce sperm and a different organ to copulate, make little silk purses in which they deposit their semen before transferring it to the necessary body part prior to mating. These various uses require different kinds of silk, which are made in different glands. To build the classic orb web, for instance, spiders use four kinds of silk. One for the frame and radial threads, another for the scaffolding that's used during construction, and then often removed when the web is complete. A third, silk, to anchor the web to fixed surfaces, and a fourth to create the spiral-shaped capture zone in the center. Should something delectable stumble into this zone, it will swiftly find itself encased like a foil-wrapped falafel sandwich from a food cart in yet a fifth kind of silk. You might imagine, based on this, that a web is a kind of biological mousetrap, but it is far more sophisticated than that, and better understood as an externalized sensory system. Most spiders can see, thanks to their excess of eyes, and some have exceptionally acute vision, but none of them have ears or even antennae, as insects do. Instead, the web itself functions like an antenna, picking up and amplifying sounds from as far away as 30 feet, Nelson writes. Scientists suspect that spiders can effectively hear these sounds as the waves propagate to them through the web. The ability of spiders to detect information via their webs is, thanks to another crucial but icky arachnid feature, hairiness. Much like the hairs in your inner ears, the hairs, technically scintilla, on a spider's legs stir in response to vibrations, such as those created when something bumbles into a strand of silk. These vibrations help the spider determine the size and the location of its victim, and, as their frequency and amplitude change, the spider can determine something else, too. When the struggling creature is exhausted enough that it is safe to approach, that's where the venom comes in. I am sorry to say that almost all spiders are venomous. In fact, if a creature is venomous, odds are good that it's a spider. According to Nelson, there are more venomous spiders than there are venomous animals of all other kinds combined. Wandering spiders, those that don't build webs, rely on venom to attack prey, whereas web-building spiders use venom and silk together. Among these web builders, some varieties tend to bite their prey first and wrap it in silk afterward. Others wrap first, rotating their victim as if on a spit while pulling sheets of silk around it. Only when it is immobilized do they inject it with venom. There are many variations on this basic practice, including some species that, in the spider equivalent of patting the head while rubbing the stomach, manage to bite and wrap at the same time. Perhaps the most impressive version is that of the pale spitting spider, whose name derives from its unusual capacity to eject a particularly gluey form of silk, not from its spinnerets, but from its fangs. Upon encountering a potential meal, it sprays a vast quantity of this goo all over it, a process that takes less than a millisecond. In addition to being supremely sticky, this specialized fang silk dramatically contracts on contact, leaving the victim essentially shrink-wrapped. Once that's accomplished, the spider approaches and bites the creature. This time, what emerges from its fangs is venom. How much venom that spider or any other uses is a matter of spiderly discretion. A creature that is especially large or especially feisty will get a bigger dose. One that is smaller or already exhausted will get a smaller one, or even none at all, a so-called dry bite, a kind of spider psych-out reserved for prey that is basically harmless. Remarkably, spiders can control not only how much venom they use, but also what kind, because venom glands and ducts have separate sections containing different toxins. Spiders can customize their output for different prey, thereby designing the maximally debilitating cocktail on the spot. Unfortunately for spider victims everywhere, that venom, no matter how bespoke or abundant it might be, is seldom lethal. In most cases, it paralyzes rather than kills, whereupon the spider vomits a bunch of extremely potent digestive fluid on top of its future dinner. In other words, like some of its sensory systems, the spider's digestive system is externalized. It takes place not in the spider's belly, but in the prey itself, where the regurgitated enzymes break down the creature's soft tissue, effectively pureeing it alive. Once that process is complete, the spider sucks up the liquid results, leaving any indigestible material behind. Given the gruesomeness of arachnid eating habits, it might seem reasonable to worry about a spider turning its pointy, poison-dripping fangs on us. Far be it from me to question the legitimacy of any spider-based phobia, but I am duty-bound to report that the fear of their bites is largely ungrounded. Fewer than 0.5% of spider species possess venom that is toxic to humans. Although Nelson is generally in the business of doing PR for the spider community, she hopefully provides a complete list of the offenders: recluse spiders found in warm regions around the world, sand spiders found in deserts in Africa and the Americas, Brazilian wandering spiders found in Central and South America, mouse spiders found in Chile and Australia, Australian funnel web spiders found only in Australia, Poecilotheria tarantulas found in India and Sri Lanka, not in Costa Rican kitchens, and widow spiders found pretty much everywhere. Of these, perhaps the most dangerous are the Australian funnel web spiders, especially the Sydney funnel web spider, not because it is more venomous than other members of its family, but because it lives in close proximity to 5.5 million people. Aggressive when attacked, say by an unsuspecting foot sliding into an occupied shoe, funnel web spiders will sometimes bite repeatedly with fangs allegedly capable of penetrating toenails. Their venom, although not lethal to most vertebrates, is deadly to primates. A 2-day-old mouse can withstand nearly 10 times the dose that will all but instantly kill a macaque. Happily for Aussies, there's an anti-venom for funnel web spider bites, and there have been no documented deaths from them since it was introduced in 1981. There's also an anti-venom for widow spiders, whose venom contains a neurotoxin that can cause muscle spasms, sweating, and tachycardia, but it is rarely used and scarcely necessary. Unlike funnel web spiders, widow spiders are not particularly aggressive and often deliver dry bites. According to Nelson, fewer than half of people bitten show any symptoms, and under 2% have severe ones. No one in the United States is known to have died of a black widow bite in at least 40 years. For my money, the most alarming venomous spider is the brown recluse. Even though it is a mild-mannered creature that generally cohabits harmlessly with humans, to provoke it into biting, you must be the aggressor, even if accidentally, say, by rolling over on it while you're sleeping. Even if it does respond by biting you, the bites are often dry and the symptoms mostly minor. In a small number of cases, however, a recluse bite causes necrosis of human tissue. In an even smaller number, typically involving young children, it can be fatal. What makes this especially scary is that, unlike for widow and funnel web bites, there is no known cure. Before you call the exterminator, however, consider these reassuring figures. Worldwide, somewhere between 3 and 7 people die of spider bites each year, putting the odds of meeting your maker that way at significantly worse than 1 in a billion. That doesn't prevent people from routinely showing up in emergency rooms seeking help for spider bites, 90 to 96% of which turn out not to be spider bites at all. The brown recluse is routinely blamed for bites that occur in places where the species has never been found. Other species have faced similar character assassinations. Wolf spiders are terrifying looking, with enormous bodies and long, thick legs. But the anti-venom developed for their bites and used for decades turns out to be unnecessary because their venom is not toxic to humans. One might reasonably wonder, if spiders almost never cause us real harm, why are so many people afraid of them? Between 3 and 15% of the population suffers from full-blown arachnophobia, making it not only one of the most common animal phobias, but one of the most common phobias overall, up there with heights and flying and ahead of needles and crowded places. Those numbers do not reflect the far larger share of people whose aversion to spiders does not quite rise to the level of pathology. The source of this broad anti-arachnid sentiment seems unlikely to be evolutionary. For one thing, arachnophobia is prevalent in places with no dangerous spider species whatsoever. For another, even before modern medical interventions, spiders did not pose a significant threat to human beings. If anything, they are good for our health, since they carry no known diseases, but are voracious consumers of insects that do, including tsetse flies and malarial mosquitoes. In fact, the strongest evolutionary case for arachnophobia rests on the dangers not of spiders, but of scorpions. The theory being that we generalized a reasonable fear of those creatures into a fear of their classmates, so to speak. It's true that roughly 25% of scorpion species are toxic to humans, and even with antivenoms, their stings kill some 3,000 people a year. The problem is that scorpions and spiders don't actually look very much alike. By the same logic, we should all be afraid of moths based on their similarity, such as it is, to hornets. And there's another problem with this theory. If concern for our safety were the main driver of phobias, we would all be considerably more scared of dogs, lions, elephants, and hippopotamuses. But, of course, we are not. And as I read Nelson's book, it occurred to me for the first time that my fear of spiders exists in the absolute absence of any fear that I'll be bitten. I suppose that's what makes it a phobia, a fear uninformed and unassuaged by rationality. Wherever we might look for the origins of arachnophobia, then, it's not in the land of reason. It's in what you might call the land of OOG. Something about spiders just weirds us out. The nature writer David Quammen, grappling with humanity's widespread fear of spiders and snakes, once floated what you might call the too many or too few theory. Both creatures, he wrote, defy the range of legginess that's standard for most of the animal kingdom, namely four legs, give or take two. He then dismissed the idea, since, if it were correct, people would also be terrified of oysters, which have no legs, and lobsters, which have 10. Yet I believe there's something to it. Survey arachnophobes, and you will learn that one of the things we find most disturbing about spiders is how they move. Uncannily, unpredictably, and incredibly fast. Not to mention up walls and across ceilings. As it happens, this aversion is grounded in a fascinating physical reality. Spiders move differently than virtually every other animal on the planet, relying not on muscles, but on a built-in hydraulic system. I suspect that this is the key to why so many of us find spiders creepy. It's not their legs, per se, but the fact that they are dramatically unlike us in almost every respect. Consider their eyes, which are as round and globular as fish eggs, often disproportionately large, but not in the Dewey Walt Disney way. Variable in size even on the same spider, and arranged in such bizarre ways that it's hard for our brains to even parse them as eyes, let alone determine where the spider is looking, to say nothing of what it is thinking. Consider, too, their penchant for post-coital cannibalism. Consider their disgusting table manners and their grisly practice of wrapping their prey in winding sheets. What with one thing and another, spiders are all but indistinguishable from the countless horror movie creatures that they have inspired. On top of this, and speaking of horror movies, spiders suffer from terrible reputation management. Their depictions in literature, film, and folklore run a short gamut from icky to deadly, and the small handful of exceptions aren't potent enough to tip the balance. For every Charlotte, there are 100 Little Miss Muffets. For every Itsy Bitsy, 1,000 Aragogs. What's worse, their depiction in real life is almost as bad. This is an order of animals whose named members include the ogre-faced spider, the assassin spider, the skull spider, the ghost spider, the goblin spider, the vampire spider, and a recently discovered species from Sri Lanka known in Latin as Psilotheria rajai and colloquial as the face-sized tarantula. What's to love, then? Lots, Nelson insists. Quash your native repugnance, she advises us, and consider the astonishing things that spiders can do. Colinus purpureus, found throughout the American South and Midwest, can jump almost 40 times its body length, or 6 times farther, relatively speaking, than my heretofore impressive house cats. The flick-flack huntsman spider, native to Morocco, can double its running speed by turning cartwheels over the local sand dunes. Even the humble daddy longlegs has a trick up its 8 sleeves. When threatened, it spins at such high speeds that it turns into a blur, making it almost impossible for a predator to attack it. The hairs on the legs of the tiger bromeliad spider look alarming, but Nelson writes that they may be the most refined sensory organ known to science, able to respond to 1/100th of the energy contained in a single photon of green light. In addition to making the case for individual species like these, Nelson argues for a new understanding of the order as a whole. Long maligned, not only as creepy, but as dim-witted and instinct-driven, spiders turn out to be capable of learning, decision-making, sophisticated navigation, even number recognition. Moreover, the very features that make them most alien to us also make them potentially advantageous. Engineers are studying the unusual mechanics of spider motion to create both robots and human prosthetics. Optics designers are looking to spiders' visual systems to supply ever smaller lenses with depth of focus and high resolution. And everyone, from biomedical researchers to material scientists, is trying to synthesize spider silk, given its unparalleled combination of lightness, toughness, and elasticity. Add to all this the environmental case for spiders, which are crucial members of almost every ecosystem on Earth, yet are drastically underrepresented on endangered species lists, presumably because they are widely regarded as what you might call repulsive microfauna. Finally, there is the existential case for spiders. The idea that their fate is somehow bound up with our own, not only ecologically, but emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually. I am not thinking here of that fiery theologian Jonathan Edwards, although he was a huge admirer of spiders, writing a thesis on them in his youth and using them, and the most famous sermon he ever delivered, as stand-ins for unsaved souls. I am thinking instead of Walt Whitman, who, in a more generous gloss on the Calvinist take, watched a spider exploring its surroundings by launching filament, filament, filament out of itself, and saw in that behavior our own perilous and hopeful situation, how we cast out into the vast unknown, till the bridge you need be formed, till the ductile anchor hold, till the gossamer thread you fling catch somewhere. It's humbling to see a creature I've always reviled rendered so beautifully. Humbling, too, to be reminded of what none of us should ever forget, that reflexively hating anything alien to us is the beginning of evil. That is not just a lesson about spiders, of course. Whitman, in his unbounded adoration of everything, also managed to love humanity, both for our wonderful strangeness and in spite of our own infinite varieties of hideousness. Next, from the February 13, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, What the Assault on Public Education Means for Kids with Disabilities. The future of the Department of Education may hinge on the worldviews of 2 billionaires who abhor what they perceive as weakness and waste, by Jessica Winter. President Donald Trump, winner of the Battle of the Billionaires at WrestleMania 23, has maintained close ties with Linda McMahon, the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment, for decades. During the president's first term, she served for 2 years as head of the Small Business Administration, stepping down in 2019 to lead America First Action, a pro-Trump super PAC. Now, McMahon is Trump's nominee to run the U.S. Department of Education, although she may appear to lack conventional bona fides for the position. She did spend a year on the Connecticut Board of Education, although it later emerged that she did not have a degree in education, as she had claimed. If McMahon is confirmed by the Senate, her odd task will be to take charge of an agency in order to euthanize it. I told Linda, "Linda, I hope you do a great job and put yourself out of a job," Trump said on February 4th. His administration wants to abolish the Department of Education, which would require an act of Congress, or at least to shrink its remit, which encompasses the federal student loan program, Title I funding for low-income districts, special education services for students with disabilities, civil rights complaints, and more. In fact, this demolition work is well underway. Members of Elon Musk's Slash and Burn DOGE squad have been inside the agency for the past week, placing staff members on paid leave and, according to the Washington Post, feeding sensitive data from across the education department into artificial intelligence software to probe the agency's programs and spending. AI may have informed the agency's decision to cancel $900 million worth of existing contracts related to education research. NBC News reported that the agency will conduct an internal review aimed at ensuring that department grants do not fund discriminatory practices, including in the form of DEI. On February 7th, Democratic members of Congress attempted to enter the Department of Education building, only to have a security guard block their path. When one of the congressional representatives posted on X about the incident, Musk replied, "No such department exists in the federal government." The Department of Education, assuming it exists, has the smallest staff of any cabinet agency, and its duties aren't necessarily well understood by the general public. Descriptions of its mission tend to rely on words like administer and oversight, terms which feel sticky with red tape. It does not decide how K-12 students in public schools are taught and evaluated. That's mostly the purview of individual states and local school districts. In most of those districts, the federal government provides a relatively modest percentage of a school's budget, usually in the ballpark of 13%, although it varies state by state. Trump often speaks in terms of sending all education and education work and needs back to the states. But most of the work of public education is already being done at the state and local level. Still, gutting the agency would deliver a terrible blow to public schools, particularly in rural areas and in high-density, low-income urban districts, which receive larger shares of their funding from the federal government. Advocates also fear that dismantling the Department of Education would have an immediate and tangible impact on students with disabilities. McMahon's mission is aligned with the school choice or education freedom movement, which opponents say seeks to erode people's trust in public schools by starving them of resources, most tangibly through the support of charter schools and voucher programs, and by whipping up destabilizing controversies over critical race theory and gender ideology. The weaponry used by the school choice movement in its attacks on public schools can be seen in two executive orders which President Trump issued on January 29th. One of those orders directed cabinet agencies to review how states can use federal funds to, quote, support families who choose educational alternatives to governmental entities, including private and faith-based options, end quote. In other words, the Trump administration wants to nationalize the K-12 voucher programs already offered in 17 states, in which public money is rerouted to parents who want to put it toward tuition at a private or parochial school, or toward homeschooling expenses. The other executive order, which addressed ending radical indoctrination in K-12 schooling, threatened to withhold federal funding from any school that foists anti-American, subversive, harmful, and false ideologies on our nation's children, including steering students towards surgical and chemical mutilation and demanding acquiescence to white privilege. It also instructed the heads of multiple agencies to devise plans to monitor and punish such schools. Dan Stewart, the managing attorney for education and employment at the National Disability Rights Network, a legal advocacy group, told me that through these executive orders, quote, this administration is engaging with education at the micro level as well as the macro level. It's looking at curriculum, which is traditionally in the power of the local schools and the state, at the same time that it's looking at different ways of moving public dollars out of the system, end quote. There's ample evidence that voucher programs have negative educational outcomes and place an enormous strain on state budgets. They are not popular at the ballot box either. In the most recent election cycle, Kentucky voted almost 2-1 against Amendment 2, which would have permitted the state legislature to put tax dollars toward charter schools and vouchers. Strikingly, the measure did not receive a majority in a single county across the state. Pro-school choice ballot measures also failed in Colorado and Nebraska. Still, both the America First Policy Institute, AFPI, the public policy think tank, which McMahon chairs, and the Heritage Foundation, where Project 2025 germinated, have backed the Educational Choice for Children Act, which would introduce a federal tax credit to incentivize charitable donations to voucher programs. The AFPI estimates that the bill would enable 85-90% of students in the nation to benefit from school choice via scholarships, and singled out Arizona's voucher program as a successful model, one which has, quote, saved taxpayer money and come in under budget, end quote. This is a mind-bending endorsement by McMahon's think tank. According to the nonprofit Save Our Schools Arizona, the state's school choice program costs $900 million over the 2023-24 fiscal year, exceeding its budget by $300 million. It now accounts for nearly half of Arizona's overall budget shortfall. Most of the families who enrolled in the program were not moving their children out of public schools. The vouchers instead serve as a discount on the private tuition they were already paying, and, as SOS Arizona put it, represent an entirely new cost to the state. Even setting aside the grim financial burdens imposed by voucher programs, there are many families for whom education freedom does not offer much in the way of school choice. Some of these families live in rural and often Republican-dominated communities where private school options are limited or non-existent, and where public schools are major local employers. Voucher programs only bleed their budgets. Other families cannot afford to make up the difference between the scholarship their child receives through a state voucher program and the actual tuition charged by local private schools. And still others have children with physical, intellectual, or social, emotional disabilities whose rights in school are guaranteed in the federal law known as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, IDEA. The vast majority of IDEA rights only apply to public school students, Jessica Levin, who is litigation director at the Nonprofit Education Law Center, told me. IDEA mandates certification requirements for special education teachers and shields students from being punished for manifestations of their disability. It also enshrines parents' rights to be involved in developing their children's education plans and to argue for more or different services, which can range from speech-language or occupational therapy to assistive technology. These rights are all lost when a student goes to a private school, Levin said. Project 2025 proposes rolling federal Title I and special education funding into block grants, which states can administer without extensive federal oversight. The states would no longer have a check on how they are complying with IDEA or other federal laws, Stewart said. The likely scenario for kids with special needs, he went on, is fewer teachers, fewer funds, delayed funds, and less certainty. Of course, according to the school choice movement, parents who are dissatisfied with their child's cash-strapped public school should have the opportunity to choose a private one in a thriving educational marketplace. In reality, Levin said, private schools are legally allowed to not accept students with disabilities or serve them appropriately. And so you end up with a higher concentration of higher need students in schools that now have fewer resources. A dismal irony of the intersection of school choice and special education is that not even the most vehement supporter of public schools would argue that the system currently works well for kids with disabilities. Currently, the federal government only provides around 13% of the average per student cost of special education services under IDEA, down from its original pledge of 40% a half century ago when IDEA was first passed into law. The vast majority of states do not fully fund special education, leaving districts to cover the gap by dipping into their general education budgets. Or not. Often they don't provide the legally mandated services at all. Public and private schools alike, Stewart told me, are incentivized to view students with disabilities as, quote, a drain on their resources, end quote. Underfunded districts in red, blue, and purple states routinely fail these students, whether they are illegally capping the percentage of children who can receive services or willfully keeping parents in the dark about their constitutional rights. IDEA is perhaps a law too aptly named, as its protections often seem more theoretical than concrete. But if public education devolves into state voucher programs, as it could under the Trump administration, families will lose support in both theory and practice. And the possible effects on kids with special needs could be compounded by Trump's radical indoctrination executive order. Although the order targets diversity efforts which focus on race, color, sex, or national origin, the conceptual framework of DEI includes the goal of greater accessibility and inclusion for people with disabilities. It's not clear whether Trump, Musk, and their supporters realize that an assault on DEI can be logically construed as an assault on rights for the disabled. The attack on DEI as a whole implicates long-standing interpretations of disability rights that have been ratified by the Supreme Court and federal courts, Stewart said. They are changing the underlying legal and social understandings of disability, even though that's not the primary goal of the attack. The future of the Department of Education and of the students with disabilities who depend on it will likely hinge less on the person appointed to lead it than on the worldviews of two billionaires who abhor what they perceive as weakness and waste. Children, alas, are weak and wasteful by nature, to say nothing of a child who needs a wheelchair, a hearing aid, or a paraprofessional. Trump and Musk's public statements are instructive here. In 2023, Musk fired a longtime employee of his who has muscular dystrophy and then ridiculed him on Twitter, falsely claiming that he, quote, did no actual work, end quote. Musk later apologized and indicated that the employee could remain at Twitter. He did not. As for Trump, according to a memoir written by his nephew, the disability advocate Fred Trump III, the president once commented that some disabled people should just die, and said of Fred's own son, who is nonverbal and uses a wheelchair owing to a rare genetic disorder, maybe you should just let him die. These remarks may be useful to keep in mind as we watch what befalls the Department of Education in the weeks and months to come. Our leaders don't want to make public education run more efficiently or to strengthen it through competition. They just think it does no actual work and that they should let it die. And now, a poem from the February 3, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, The Bay, by David Baker. How many stories among the stars? The boats come in, the boats go out. Our friend is dying. He writes, he says, more often, yet more sparely, now to see what wasn't seen before. We stay up all night again to scan the sky from our deck above the bay. How slow the constellations spin, invincible heroes, unrequited loves, until it seems we've lost all count. Soon we'll go to star, therefore, to start. A cargo freighter pulls across the waters. We can tell from the placement of the lights, the slow procession of it all. And so it's dawn. Did I say invincible? I mean invisible. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.